Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. This is Democracy Now!
Anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. If you don't find this a high crime and misdemeanor today, you have set a new terrible standard for presidential misconduct in the United States of America.
Democratic House impeachment managers urge senators to convict Donald Trump as they wrap up their opening arguments in the historic impeachment trial. But are Democrats making a major mistake by rushing the trial?
They don't seem to be willing to call witnesses and have a longer trial. They want to get it over with, which is exactly what the Republicans want.
Where are the witnesses? We speak to longtime consumer advocate, former presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Then, this Sunday, February 14th, is V-Day, a global day to end violence against women and girls. We'll speak to the activist and playwright V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, as well as the poet Aja Monet.
Dear Black women, do you have a story to tell? We are the poetic philosophers of an unseen world, the very language of difference and magic. This time demands our active listening and our critical storytelling for the world we want to see.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House impeachment managers have concluded their case against former President Donald Trump, linking his campaign to undermine the election results with the statements of insurrectionists who attacked the U.S. Capitol January 6th. In closing arguments, Colorado Congressmember Joe Neguse pleaded with senators to vote to convict Trump.
Because if you don't, if we pretend this didn't happen, or worse, if we let it go unanswered, who's to say it won't happen again?
Trump's legal team begins its defense today. Lawyer David Schoen predicted it would take just 3 to 4 hours to present Trump's case, with the trial set to wrap on Saturday. On Thursday evening, three Republican senators, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, and Mike Lee, met with Trump's legal team in the Capitol, raising fresh doubts over their ability to serve as impartial jurors. After headlines, we'll air extended excerpts from Trump's second Senate impeachment trial and get reaction from longtime consumer advocate and multi-presidential candidate Ralph Nader. The United States reported nearly 3,900 new deaths from COVID-19 Thursday, pushing the U.S. death toll past 475,000, by far the highest in the world. Here in New York, the top aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo apologized to Democratic lawmakers this week for not initially reporting close to half of the 15,000 deaths at nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Meanwhile, California has surpassed New York as the state with the highest death toll, with over 46,000 COVID deaths reported. Health officials in Los Angeles temporarily closed 5 vaccination centers Thursday, including a massive site at Dodger Stadium after the city ran out of vaccines. In Bethesda, Maryland, President Biden visited the National Institutes of Health, where he slammed Donald Trump's failure to prepare for mass vaccinations.
He didn't order enough vaccines. He didn't mobilize enough people to administer the shots. He didn't set up a federal vaccine centers where eligible people could go and get their shots.
President Biden says his administration has secured the 200 million vaccine doses from Pfizer and Moderna he announced last month, meaning there will be enough shots to inoculate 300 million U.S. residents by the end of July. Meanwhile, Stat News reports U.S. COVID-19 vaccination rates closely track with wealth, with the richest gaining access to vaccines at a faster pace than low-income people. The vaccine wealth gap has exacerbated racial disparities, with Black and Latinx people receiving far fewer vaccines proportionately than white people. This comes amidst warnings over growing global inequity in vaccine distribution. Duke University health researcher Andrea Taylor told The Washington Post, quote, "It remains to a large degree a zero-sum game, which means that every dose that goes to the U.S. or the U.K. or an EU country is a dose that's off the shelves, and the shelves aren't going to be restocked for a while." The New York Times reports former President Trump was far sicker with COVID-19 last October than previously reported, with extremely depressed blood oxygen levels and compromised lungs due to viral pneumonia. The Times reports Trump was taken to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center after officials believed he would need to be put on a ventilator. Trump ultimately recovered after an aggressive treatment that included a monoclonal antibody cocktail, which at the time was unavailable to members of the general public. In Afghanistan, gunmen attacked a United Nations convoy on the outskirts of Kabul, killing five Afghan security force escorts. A government official said the Taliban was suspected, but they denied involvement. Around the country, there were multiple other reports of deadly violence in Afghanistan Thursday, as well as non-fatal shooting of journalist Qutbuddin Kuhi. Intra-Afghan peace talks have largely stalled, according to officials. Over two dozen lawmakers are calling on President Joe Biden to consider the devastating impacts of harsh U.S. sanctions on countries around the world, particularly the coronavirus pandemic. During this time, the lawmakers write sanctions have, quote, harmed civilian populations, caused authoritarian governments to further constrict civil spaces and repress civil and political rights, squeeze the ability of humanitarian organizations to provide support during crises and disasters, and made basic staples prohibitively expensive, unquote. In his first week in office, Biden said his administration would review all U.S. sanctions currently in place. In related news, the Justice Department said this week the U.S. has sold over a million barrels of Iranian fuel seized by civil forfeiture as part of its sanctions campaign. U.S. officials say they seized the oil last year from tankers headed from Iran to Venezuela. The money will be transferred to the U.S. Victims of State-Sponsored Terrorism Fund, according to a Justice Department spokesperson. China's banned the BBC's World News Channel after British authorities revoked the license of the state-run Chinese broadcaster CGTN. The move was largely symbolic because the BBC was already unavailable to the vast majority of China's population. In immigration news, BuzzFeed reports asylum seekers forced to stay in Mexico by the Trump administration will soon be allowed to start entering the U.S. Efforts to phase out Trump's Remain in Mexico program are expected to begin within the next 2 weeks. Immigrant rights activists are calling for President Biden to fully abolish the policy. The program has forced tens of thousands of asylum seekers to wait in dangerous conditions in crowded and squalid refugee camps across northern Mexico while their cases make their way through U.S. courts. In related news, the Biden administration's canceled a Trump-era national emergency order to allocate government funding for the construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall. This comes as immigrant justice advocates continue to denounce President Biden's interest in ramping up surveillance technology at the southern border, which opponents refer to as a virtual wall. A warning to our viewers, the following stories contain disturbing footage and descriptions of violence. in Texas. Authorities are searching for a tanker truck in the San Antonio area where some 80 migrants may be trapped. In a chilling 911 call Monday, a man speaking in Spanish told the dispatcher they were struggling to breathe. "We can't see anything. God, we have no oxygen," the man said. Other people are heard screaming for help in the background. A recent court filing in the 2010 case of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas, a Mexican man who was beaten and shocked to death by border agents, reveals the current head of Border Patrol, Chief Rodney Scott, was part of efforts to protect the agents involved and interfere with the criminal investigation. Rojas lay on the ground handcuffed at the San Ysidro port of entry in San Diego as agents beat him with batons and shocked him with a stun gun. He died at the hospital several days later. The case is currently under review by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. It's the first time the commission has looked into an extrajudicial killing at the hands of a U.S. law enforcement agency. A grand jury in Buffalo, New York, has cleared two police officers who assaulted the 75-year-old racial justice protester last June named Martin Gugino. A longtime peace activist, he suffered a brain injury, a fractured skull, and spent a month in the hospital after being shoved to the ground by police. A video of the incident quickly went viral. In Rochester, New York, disturbing new video has been released of the moments after police handcuffed and pepper sprayed a 9-year-old black girl last month.
Officer, please, don't do this to me.
You did it to yourself, hon.
Spray is burning my eyes.
Yep, that's the point of pepper spray. The ambulance is on their way and they will clear your eyes out.
The pepper spray is burning my eyes.
The Rochester Democrat and Chronicle newspaper reports it took about 15 minutes for an ambulance to arrive, and the 9-year-old girl was left handcuffed for 23 minutes. The officers involved were suspended pending an investigation. One of the things the little girl said to the officers when they said, "You're acting like a child," is, "I am a child." In Aurora, Colorado, a police officer was fired Thursday for use of excessive force during an arrest last August. Officer Robert Rosen punched and tased a trespassing subject multiple times inside a supermarket as the man lay on the floor. In Los Angeles, the family of Dijon Kizzy, a 29-year-old black bicyclist who was shot to death by sheriff's deputies last summer, has filed a $35 million claim for damages. Kizzy was shot 16 times after being pulled over for an alleged bike violation. His family says the sheriff's department failed to properly train its deputies and the officers used unreasonable, deadly force. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman here in New York. As we turn to what is happening right now in Washington, D.C., we're talking about this historic second impeachment of a president of the United States. That's right. We're talking about Democratic House impeachment managers having wrapped up their case against Donald Trump, saying the former president remains a threat and should be convicted of incited the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Trump's legal team begins their defense today. On Thursday, lead House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin laid out Trump's long history of inciting violence prior to January 6th.
Beginning in March, Trump leveled attacks on Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer for the coronavirus policies in her state. Then, on October 8th, the precise consequences of the president's incitement to violence were revealed to the whole world. Look at this. 13 men were arrested by the FBI for plotting to storm the Michigan State Capitol building, launch a civil war, kidnap Governor Whitmer, transport her to Wisconsin, and then try and execute her. And he did it again on October 27th during a pre-election rally speech in Lansing, Michigan, where the Capitol had been stormed. Trump openly joked with the crowd about critics saying his words had provoked the violent plot against Governor Whitmer. Check it out. It's telling.
Fire! 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 See, I don't comment on that, because every time if I make just even a little bit of a nod, they say, the president led them on. No, I don't have to lead you on. I'm the one. It was our people that helped her out with her problem. I mean, we'll have to see if it's a problem, right? People are entitled to say maybe it was a problem, maybe it was.
President Trump offered them a little winking inside joke about his constant incitement of the mob and how much can actually be communicated by him with just a little nod. Just a little nod. He presided over another pounding, rhythmic rendition of his trademark chant, lock her up, lock her up. Then, referring to the FBI's foiling of the kidnapping conspiracy, which was deadly serious, he said that he helped her out with the problem. Maybe it was a problem, maybe it wasn't. We'll have to see. Maybe it was a problem, maybe it wasn't. The president of the United States of America. He could not bring himself to publicly oppose a kidnapping and potential assassination conspiracy plot against a sitting governor of one of our 50 states. Trump knew exactly what he was doing in inciting the January 6th mob. Exactly. He had just seen how easily his words and actions inspired violence in Michigan. My dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
That was lead House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin. Democrats also focused on the statements of rioters who took part in the January 6th insurrection. This is House impeachment manager Diana DeGette, the congressmember from Colorado.
I want to step back from the horrors of the attack itself and look at January 6th from a totally different perspective, the perspective of the insurrectionists themselves. Their own statements before, during, and after the attack make clear the attack was done for Donald Trump, at his instructions, and to fulfill his wishes. Donald Trump had sent them there. They truly believed that the whole intrusion was at the president's orders. Even after the attack, the insurrectionists made clear to law enforcement that they were just following President Trump's orders. They didn't shy away from their crimes because they thought they were following orders from the commander-in-chief, and so they would not be punished. They were wrong.
House impeachment manager David Cicilline accused Donald Trump of trying to become a king.
When President Trump incited a lawless mob to attack our process, he was attacking our democracy. He was trying to become king and rule over us against the will of the people and the valid results of the election. For the first time ever in our history, a sitting president actively instigated his supporters to violently disrupt the process that provides for the peaceful transfer of power from one president to the next. Think about that for a moment. What if President Trump had been successful? What if he had succeeded in overturning the will of the people and our constitutional processes? Who among us is willing to risk that outcome by letting Trump's constitutional crimes go unanswered?
Rhode Island Congressmember Cicilline also talked about the many victims of the January 6th riot, from the Capitol Hill police officers to workers at the Capitol.
For many of the black and brown staff, the trauma was made worse by the many painful symbols of hate that were on full display that day. Insurrectionists waved Confederate flags and hurled the most disgusting racial slurs at dedicated Capitol workers. Then, after all of that, these same workers, many of them people of color, were forced to clean up the mess left by mobs of white nationalists. One member of the janitorial staff reflected how terrible he felt when he had to clean up feces that had been smeared on the wall, blood of a rioter who had died, and broken glass and other objects strewn all over the floor. He said, "I felt bad. I felt degraded."
That's House Impeachment Manager David Cicilline speaking on Thursday. Trump's legal team begins its defense today. Lawyer David Schoen predicted it would take just 3 to 4 hours. They have 16, but just 3 to 4 hours to present Trump's case. On Thursday evening, three Republican senators, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, and Mike Lee, met with Trump's legal team in the Capitol, raising fresh doubts over their ability to serve as impartial jurors. When we come back, we'll be joined by longtime consumer advocate, former presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Stay with us.
I don't mean to reproach you by saying this. I know that scares you. All of the big occasions you might have missed. No, I accept you. Forget I would know you best. I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I think your inside is your best side. Is that a teardrop in your eye? I never thought I'd see you cry. Just know whatever hurts, it's all mine. It's okay to cross.
It's Okay to Cry by the Scottish trans producer and musician Sophie. Sophie died January 30th at the age of 34. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our look at the historic second impeachment trial of Donald Trump for inciting the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, we're joined by Ralph Nader, the longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former presidential candidate. He ran for president 4 times. He's the author of many books, including his latest, written with Mark Green, Wrecking America, How Trump's Lawbreaking and Lies Betray All. He's joining us from Winsted, Connecticut. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Ralph. Thanks so much for being with us. So the Democrats have finished their case against Donald Trump in the Senate impeachment trial, this historic number two for one president. Your assessment of their arguments?
Well, Amy, it's important to know that they were operating as a civil proceeding, attorneys. This is not a criminal proceeding. It's a civil proceeding controlled completely by the U.S. Senate. The Supreme Court ruled in Nixon versus U.S. years ago that the judiciary has no role whatsoever. There's no appeal. There's no protracted delays. It's all up to the Senate, and the Senate rules, number one. Number two, the purpose of this impeachment effort is prophylactic. It's designed not just to hold Trump accountable under the Constitution, but to prevent future wannabe Trumps from behaving in the same way. And therefore, the only really result of a guilty verdict would be disqualifying Trump from running for federal office anymore. So with that background, I think people need to know that the House managers were being managed by Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She was running the show. And she has two approaches, which she used in the first impeachment. One is she likes to rush the trial. The second is the reason why she likes to rush the trial without witnesses and subpoenas is that she has prejudged the result. She basically says these Republicans are intransigent. They'll never change their mind. Our duty is to impeach in the House and send it over to the Senate. Now, that is a prescription for defeat, period. And as a result, the narrow approach of the Articles of Impeachment, keep the Democrats from having a full hand. They have like 10 arrows in their quiver, and they have, they're using one or two. Now, what they should do is call witnesses. The witnesses they should call are not surprising. Donald Trump, Mike Pence, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, some of the families of the victims, Garrett Miller or others who said they went down to the Congress on orders of their commander-in-chief who spoke to them, and John Bolton, who said that obstruction of justice was a way of life in the White House. He's a national security advisor before he resigned. Otherwise, what the Republicans will do is simply say this is a video show trial. A lot of the material was taken out of context, and the protagonists were entirely Democratic partisans, members of the House Democratic Party. And if you have witnesses, you have the potential of breakthrough testimony. Mike Pence, for example, Jay Rosen, for example, Brad Raffensperger. They might be required to testify about far deeper crimes than simply a telephone call to the Justice Department by Trump or to the Georgia Secretary of State twisting their elbows to try to change the course or the count of the election. That's the unfortunate aspect of it, Amy, that they had an opportunity. Because here you have a president who has seized congressional power. Day after day in 4 years, he spent money without authorization. He has violated congressional mandates in health, safety, and economic regulations. He has defied over 130 subpoenas and dozens of formal demands by congressional committees to testify in terms of his subordinates, cabinet and sub-cabinet levels. So there are two layers here. His street crime attack on the Congress, that was well argued by the House Democrats. But then there's the institutional separation of powers attack that was far more fundamental in terms of its long-range impact, in terms of its current impact on hundreds of millions of American people. That was not part of the articles of impeachment. They didn't go with a full hand. And had they gone with a full hand, they could have shown the intransigent Republicans exactly what price they're going to pay if they vote to acquit Donald Trump.
So talk about, for example, what Pence would have had to say. Pence, a longtime, obviously, ally of President Trump, defender almost to the end, until he decided to be there to ensure the count of the final count of the Electoral College. One of the things that the House manager showed was the timeline. I mean, maybe you can argue Trump in his speech that day when he said fight, that doesn't mean actually physically kill a police officer. But they show the timeline, for example, having to do with Pence, that President Trump called Senator Tuberville at the moment when Pence was just taken out, evacuated, and Tuberville said, I can't talk to you, to the president. Pence has just been evacuated. And it was after that that Trump issued yet another tweet against Pence and the rioters. I don't know if you would call them domestic terrorists. Would you, Ralph? Were chanting, hang Mike Pence.
Well, if you had Pence on the stand, you would start with a impeachable statement by Trump in 2019. No other president has dared say what Trump said then. He said, with Article 2, I can do whatever I want as president. With Article 2, I can do whatever I want as president. And he spent 4 years proving that that was the case with Vice President Pence. So you basically have Pence, who doesn't like to be seen as a lawless executive branch vice president, comment on all that you have just described in terms of a law and order framework. And he submitted to Trump every day until that last day when he said, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I have to obey the Constitution and go down to the Senate and formally supervise the counting of the Electoral College votes as accurate for President-elect Biden. And So he broke with him, and Trump attacked him. And that's powerful testimony. You can't reproduce that testimony with videotapes. You can't reproduce the testimony of Raffensperger and others. The situation in Georgia was really thuggishly detailed. It wasn't just a phone call. NPR had a good expose on that. He actually had his people threaten various electoral officials in Fulton County, not just a phone call and threatening Raffensperger with criminal prosecution.
And you had a U.S. attorney forced out.
Pardon?
You had a U.S. attorney forced out in Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot there to uncover. You can't do that by videotape. You have to do it by live testimony. I mean, trial lawyers say a trial without witnesses? Are you kidding? And why didn't they call the witnesses? Because Nancy Pelosi wants to get this over with, and she doesn't believe anything will change the minds of enough Republican senators. I disagree. First of all, it's not just for the Republican senators. You have a full trial with a full hand of impeachable offenses. It's for the American people. It's for public education. It's for the historic record. And it's for whatever use subsequent criminal prosecutions of Trump that are pending in New York, Georgia, and the District of Columbia may be able to apply. So it's a very narrow approach, and unfortunately, the capability of lead manager Jamie Raskin was not fully displayed because he didn't have a full hand.
So you have the prosecution possibly of Trump by the Fulton County DA. She is now speaking out and paneling a grand jury. But I also wanted to ask you about, well, Ellie Mistel's argument in The Nation. Said Trump should be charged with incitement of criminal acts at the very least. If it can be proven he stood down the National Guard, he should be charged with sedition as well. He's not a defeated politician. He's a criminal on the loose. He must be treated as such.
Well, of course. I mean, he will be. He's an ordinary citizen now, as they say. He's going to be subject to criminal prosecution. All the things that were portrayed by the House Democrats in the last few days, in an ordinary court of law, would be crimes against the state by Trump. And he's going to have to face, as I say, at least three jurisdictions, Georgia, District of Columbia, and New York State for financial misconduct with his businesses under Prosecutor Cyrus Vance. But it's important, Amy, to realize how decayed the Republican Party's become. Because when Nixon was accused of obstructing justice in the burglary of the Watergate complex that housed the Democratic National Committee, he was subject to impeachment proceedings by the House, they hadn't yet gone to the floor to formally impeach him. Senator Barry Goldwater and Senator Hugh Scott and other leading Senate Republicans went over to the White House and had a private meeting with Richard Nixon. And they basically said, your time is up. You've lost your base. You're going to be impeached and convicted. Now, compare that with the spineless, intimidated Senate Republicans, where Trump's crimes are not just institutional against the separation of powers and seizing congressional power by his White House. His crimes were street crimes, violent street crimes, endangering the lives of the very Republican senators, talking, shouting, hang Mike Pence, and pushing all the members of Congress fleeing for their lives through the hallways underground the Capitol complex, with all kinds of mayhem, fatalities, and injuries. And still, none of the Republican leaders will go to the White House figuratively or go and basically say, it's over.
And what kind of effect do you think it would have had if, for example, Eugene Goodman was brought in, the Capitol Police officer who clearly saved Mitt Romney, who led the rioters in the other direction to give Pence, to give Congress members a chance to escape? Also talking about repeatedly hearing, and this is true of a number of African-American Capitol Police, the N-word.
Well, that's why the testimony would be so powerful. That's why the witnesses are so important. Otherwise, The House managers have one last chance. They've got to make a direct appeal to the Republican senators. About 7, 8, 9 of them are going to vote to convict. They need 17. And the appeal has to be, do you know what's going to happen if you let this guy run again? If you let Trump offer the prospect of running in 2024? Do you know he controls your party? He controls the state Republican committees. He's going to basically demand 100% submission, as he did of William Barr, Attorney General, and Vice President Pence, or he's going to turn on you. Is that the kind of future political career you want
to enter? And just to be clear, you'd need these two votes. One is to convict, and you need 67 senators. The other is to stop him from running for federal office, and you just need the majority, which they already have with the Democrats.
That's right. That's right. They wouldn't have it. So what's the rush? The rush partly is due to a routine most Americans don't know about. The Congress works at the most 3 days a week when they're not in long recesses. 3 days a week. A lot of them fly in Tuesday morning and they fly back Thursday afternoon or evening. That's one reason they don't have congressional hearings and oversight of executive branch. They don't work Monday or Friday. They treasure their short work week, and it's become a habit. There's no reason why they can't work 5 days, even 6 days. This is one of the most important trials in American history. This is a trial for the future of our Constitution, for whether we're going to have a monarch, for whether we're going to have more of the sordid, cruel, violent type of electoral politics that is going on with voter suppression and voter intimidation. And they're worried about saving a few days. They can work half-time on the trial, say in the afternoon, and then do the legislative business in the morning. But Nancy Pelosi needs to be held accountable for the strategy that she put forward, a defeatist strategy in the first impeachment when there were at least 11 other proven impeachable offenses by Trump, and she just went with the Ukraine issue. And we put all these in the congressional record of December 18th. Anybody wants to look at them, Congressman John Larson put them in. And she's going with the same limited strategy here. And nobody's talking about it.
Mitch McConnell, his role, do you think it's possible he, Thune, and others could vote against President Trump? And do you think it's an absolute done deal that there's no way they'll get 67 votes? One Republican commentator said if it was a secret ballot, 90% would go against Trump, but not if it's not.
Mitch McConnell made a speech on the Senate floor directly asserting that Trump was responsible for the riot, for the mayhem, for the storming of the Capitol. He is the leader. He's got a lot of leverage. He's the key to getting those 17 votes. And for the first time in his life, he's going to face a struggle inside his brain where he can't just say no, no, no to key legislation protecting the American people. He's called himself the guardian of gridlock, the grim weeper. Those are his words. He's got to face up to history. And he is the key to getting the rest of the Republican senators. All they have to do is just look at the prospect. If Trump is acquitted, he is unleashed on them. He will demand total submission. He controls the party structure. There's nobody like him that can attract more money and more crowds, and it will be miserable for them. And if they think they can avoid some primary challenges, but they're going to equip their Democratic challenges in the election with enormous arguments to defeat them. Never mind their role in history. Never mind the example of Senator Goldwater and Senator Hugh Scott telling Nixon he better resign. His time is up.
What about what President Biden is doing, the COVID relief bill, the $1.9 trillion he's pushing for? Your evaluation of that and what he has done so far as president?
Well, that's important. You know, he's got to keep that $15 minimum wage, which is staggered over 4 years, by the way. And Bernie Sanders is pleading with him and Senate Democrats to keep it in. It has state and local aid. It has aid for children. It has aid to education. It has aid to health and vaccine and all the rest of it, that and the COVID crisis. And it's very important. It's got to be managed in a way so corporations who don't deserve it or professional sports teams who don't deserve it don't get the money. That's what happened last time. And then there are hundreds of billions of dollars of unspent money still, unspent from the Trump administration that needs to be applied to the current state of the economy. In the regulatory area, he's got to do several things. One, he's got to roll back the dismantling and illegal shutting down of enforcement agencies such as the Workplace Safety Agency, OSHA, Environmental Agency, EPA, Food and Drug Administration, the Auto Safety Agency, the FAA. He's got to roll back those executive orders, roll back those criminal non-enforcement rules that Trump actually put in place overtly. Earlier in 2020. He then has to appoint some good people and back them up. He already has appointed some good people to the Securities Exchange Committee, Gary Gensler, and a very good appointee to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Rohit Chopra. But he's got more to appoint, and he's got to back them up. Third, he's got to expand the regulatory budget, which is so tiny, it's absurd. The budget for OSHA is $500 million, which is what we have spent every year to pay for the embassy in Baghdad, in Iraq, after that criminal war by Bush and Cheney. And fourth, he's got to make sure that Congress elevates corporate crime reform to the highest visibility. We're in a corporate crime wave in this country, economically, environmentally, consumer abuse, worker abuse, and there's got to be a revision and updating of the federal corporate criminal law, which are absurdly antiquated. I mean, the fines are absurd for occupational workplace casualties, a few thousand dollars applied to an employee employer for the loss of life in the workplace from criminal negligence. And I would advise Mr. Biden to retain professor of law John Coffey of Columbia University, who's just written an excellent book called Corporate Crime and Under Enforcement. And he's the man to draft a federal corporate criminal law code.
Finally, Ralph Nader, speaking about corporate crime, I wanted to ask you about Boeing. In January, the company agreed to pay more than $2.5 billion to settle a nearly two-year federal criminal investigation into Boeing's role in the two fatal crashes in Ethiopia and Indonesia that killed all 346 on board 737 MAX airplanes, the Justice Department accusing Boeing of having concealed information about the aircraft. One of the victims was your 24-year-old great-niece, your grandniece, Samia Rose Stumo, who I had the privilege of meeting at in Winsted, where you are now, and at the Tort Museum. What's happening in these cases?
Well, this is a slap on the wrist, a just before midnight settlement between the Trump Justice Department and the Boeing lawyers. It was really nothing. There was about a $250 million fine. There was over $1 billion aid to the airlines and $500 million to the scores of families who lost their loved ones in the two crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. That settlement has not yet been approved by the federal district judge in Texas. There may be an intervention by the families, and I hope the new Justice Department reopens it under Biden and Merrick Garland, the new Attorney General, because this is just another example of giant companies getting away with their corporate criminality. A shocking sweetheart deal, an insult to the memories of the lost ones, and further endangering the safety of air travelers in the future. You have to enforce the law to deter future criminality, and this wouldn't deter Boeing in the least. And also, a lot of it is deductible under our tax system. I think people have got to realize that Systematic corporatism causes a lot of problems. Systematic corporatism feeds systematic racism, it feeds systematic workplace abuses, it feeds systematic ignoring of environmental health, it feeds systematic corruption of the political process. We've got to start using phrases like corporate crime enforcement and corporate systematic corporatism.
Well, Ralph Nader, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And again, condolences to you and your whole family. I know the pain never goes away. We will continue to follow the Boeing case. Thank you so much for being with us. Longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, former four-time presidential candidate, author of many books, the latest with Matt Green, Wrecking America, How Trump's Lawbreaking and Lies Betray Us All. Coming up Sunday, February 14th, is Valentine's Day. It also marks V-Day, the global day to end violence against women and girls. We'll speak with the activist and playwright V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, as well as the poet Aja Monet. Stay with us.
In a time of an upheaval, will come a transformation. Ignite a fire that will burn like the sun. Become a strong movement, fierce and determined, informed by where we are and where we've come from. We are those who are rising from Manila to Miami, building trust in solidarity. Love is our bond. And in the streets we are marching, twin the rape and the suffering.
We are rising by Taina Sili and 1 Billion Rising. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In what's being called the pandemic within the pandemic, domestic violence has soared across the globe over the last year. Time magazine recently reported domestic violence increased 300% in Hubei, China, 25% in Argentina, 30% in Cyprus, 33% in Singapore, and 50% in Brazil. The American Journal of Emergency Medicine reports domestic violence has also spiked across the U.S. It's up 22% in Portland, Oregon, 18% in San Antonio, over 10% in New York, as people can be trapped with their batterers at home. This Sunday marks Valentine's Day, as well as V-Day, Global Day of Action to Fight Violence Against Women and Girls. We're joined now by two guests, the playwright, V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of V-Day. She's the author of The Vagina Monologues and many other works. We're also joined by the poet Aja Monet, V-Day's new artistic creative director. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! As I read out those figures, V, about domestic violence soaring in the world as people are alone in homes, sometimes with their batterers, can you fit that into what's happening this Sunday around the world?
Yes. I mean, obviously, we're here. It's so funny because I've been doing a lot of online risings this year because people can't be in the streets, a lot of people because of COVID. And we're hearing about these incredible numbers of domestic violence and all kinds of other violences. The violences of frontline workers, mainly women, women of color being exposed to all kinds of things without protections. There's endless violences. And I just want to say I'm so moved to see our grassroots women movements around the world finding ways to rise in spite of people being locked in and shut in and in spite of COVID. I think what I'm excited to be talking with you about this morning, and happy V-Day to everybody, is this new program that we're doing, which and this new campaign that Aja Monet is leading up. And I just want to just briefly talk about that for a second, because it directly feeds into all the statistics you were talking about. I think during this last year in America and across the world, we've seen some of the most hideous murders of black men and women and trans women by the police, and an escalation of white supremacy. And most recently, the horrific murder of Breonna Taylor, and still injustice that's followed it. And I know for me, I've been doing a lot of reflection in V-Day, as has our whole team. This movement that's been here for 23 years and has really been supported, initiated and driven by the Vagina Monologues. And I think this year we all decided we needed to go further. We needed to go deeper. Something more is being called for. And I've been doing deep reflection about my life as a white woman playwright and activist, and fully aware of the depth of my privilege and access to networks and resources that have helped to produce my work. And I believe this is the moment where we need to uplift and be in deepest solidarity with black women, cis women, trans women, non-binary people across the African continent and African diaspora. And we need to share our networks and resources that will bring their voices into the center of our movement. So I am thrilled that we have invited and joined with the forces of the powerhouse and the visionary that is Aja Monet, someone who really understands the connection between art and activism, who is a brilliant poet in her own right and has been curating this piece filled with the stories of black women throughout the world.
Well, Aja, I want to turn to you next, and just giving a little background. You're the youngest poet to have ever become the New Eurekan Poets Cafe Grand Slam champion at the age of 19 in 2007. That's just way back then. But you're doing remarkable things. And I was wondering if you can describe the Voice Project.
Yeah, so we also know that for every black woman who reports rape, at least 15 black women do not. You know, one in four black girls will be sexually abused before the age of 18. So these statistics, you can list, we can go down the list and see the impact that sexual violence and harm and abuse has had on black women primarily, but around on women across the world. Voices is a project that for us, we're deeply invested in how do we interrogate the interior landscapes of people and their relationship, not just to violence, but to liberation and freedom. How does art become critical in the ways that we imagine the world we want to see, and to start to practice, to actively engage people beyond just speaking and telling the truth, but also showing and demonstrating what active listening looks like, how we show up for those who are speaking, how we engage and how we show compassion and collective care in this moment. I want to say that I think the biggest thing that really impacted me last year, while there was an uprising around George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, was a story about a Tallahassee activist, a black girl, Nigerian black American woman named Oluwatoyin Salau, who was assaulted and murdered, seeking protection and seeking shelter. In a moment where she was actively engaging in our movement to fight for us and to fight for our trans brothers and sisters. And so to note that this was a story that was kind of left out of the narrative of this moment, not for any, I wouldn't say intentional purposes, but it is something that begs of us to pay attention, to listen deeper, to go into our communities and to see how are we internalizing the harm and the violence of this country, and how do we show up better in our movements for one another?
As you say her name, talk about the Say Her Name movement.
I think that Say Her Name was born out of a necessity in a moment where media was hyper-focused on the violence and the ways that police violence was showing up in our communities around black men and the stories of black men. Say Her Name is a campaign that was created to support the voices of black women all over the country, but particularly around state violence and the ways that state violence is also impacting us, not just through policing, but also through reproductive rights and issues that we're facing in our maternal mortality, right? Also in the ways that we suffer from housing inequality, the ways that climate change impacts our communities, that we recognize that saying her name is not in an effort to combat the names or to resist the notion that our brothers' names need to be stated, but that also our Black women are on the front lines of often most of the violence that our communities see. And so therefore, we must lift up the memories and the stories of those directly impacted by this violence.
And finally, Aja, on the issue of art and resistance, if you could talk as an artist about how your art has changed through the pandemic and what you're hoping for most of all on Sunday with Billions Rising.
Yeah. Well, we believe that art is, you know, for the people, by the people. And it's about presence. It's about attention. It's about expression of one's psychic terrain, the interior world, the last frontier. And so I think a big part of what we see this project being, Voices, is our unothering. We create because we have no other choice in this moment, right? We want to create out of a space of what do we envision, what do we want to see, not just so much what we're against and what we're fighting. And so I think we create because we're possessed by our questions. We're not creating because we believe we have the answers. We create because we know that art has the capacity to get the people to be challenged, to be intrigued, and to be transformed by their expressions of their interior world and their presence. For me, during this moment, we found ways for art with homemade poetry online series that we started, for art to be a part of helping us think through solutions. How can art help us practice the world that we want to see? How can art also provide the remedies for the moment? And what are the limitations of art, right? How does art become strategy for our freedom, not just an accessory to our movement? And those are the things that I've seen happen in this moment, are the ways that artists are being engaged critically around the cultural shifts we need for our society to be where it needs to go. Abolition is on the tongues of everyone's mouths because of culture, because of cultural workers, because of the folks on the front lines organizing for that change and for the relationships built between artists and organizers during this moment. I would say organizers are artists, that we are actively practicing our creative imaginations and pushing the conversation and pushing the nation forward. We're the shamans and healers of this moment. So I want to lift up all the organizers who are doing work to end violence against women and girls, but to end violence against those of us who are most marginalized across the globe.
And finally, February 14th, 1998, that's when you began V-Day. We're talking more than 20 years. Do you feel there has been major progress, and where are you headed in that work?
Well, I think with everything with patriarchy, it's two steps forward and one step back. It's a persistent, ongoing virus that we're up against. But I think there has been change. And I just want to say about this year, our theme this year is 1 billion rising gardens. And it's been incredible to see how it's amplifying the intersectional issues of women's inequality, impact on food insecurity, land ownership, and lack of access to health care, as well as the long-term effects of extractive industries on the destruction of Mother Earth and other basic rights for frontline and marginalized communities. And I want to urge everybody to go to 1billionrising.org. There are incredible things going on right now. Just everywhere on the globe, our 60 global coordinators have unleashed vast grassroots, regionally and national actions. We're seeing them dig deep into their communities, seed distribution, seed banks exchanges in India and Congo and the Philippines. Last night I was on the phone with organizers in Davao, Philippines, with the LUMAD women, the indigenous women who are rising to take back their lands from the plunderers and the people pillaging it and the corporates destroying it. And these are just archaic and horrible anti-terrorist laws that Duterte has put into place, where he's just summarily arresting people without any charges. We're seeing people do artistic creations for zero waste food art in Bangladesh, Rising Garden film festivals in South Asia. We're seeing artistic risings all over Africa, Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Mexico, Italy. And I just want to urge everybody.
V, we have 10 seconds.
April 22nd, Earth Day, rise, plant your gardens in this country. Join Vias for Voices. Send in your stories in the next 2 days and be part of our movement.
Thank you so much, V, formerly known as Eve Ensler, founder of V-Day, and Aja Monet, the poet and V-Day's new artistic creative director. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.